This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. We'll chat with one of the brightest young violinists on the scene today. After over a decade of study with Itzhak Perlman and completing her studies at Juilliard, she has a vibrant career in hand as a noted chamber musician, a concertmaster in demand, and even running her own chamber music festival out west. But it is what she did all by herself with perhaps the greatest music ever composed for solo violin, her 33-day-long traveling performances of Johann Sebastian Bach's 6 sonatas and partitas for violin all around New York City at a wide variety of very public and unexpected places and venues that has captured many listeners' imagination and curiosity. The courage, stamina, and musical integrity with which she approached this project is impressive and fascinating. The unexpected at times results and aftermath enlightening, all in her effort to bring music, in this case Bach, to the people. She'll be incorporating those works with music by other composers in an enthralling program at Le Poisson Rouge in Greenwich Village this Sunday. I'll give details at the end of our chat. Her recordings of these seminal works by Bach has just been released on CD on the Albany label. Throughout the program, we'll hear excerpts from these recordings by my guest playing Bach, with one exception. A little later, we'll hear her in her own improvisation inspired by this music of Bach. The music you hear now is the first movement of the final entry into this solo violin journey, or as my guest calls it, a cathedral dome, the Preludio from the Partita in E Major, BWV 1006. I caught up with Michelle Ross in New York City last week. I'm here today with violinist Michelle Ross. Strangely enough, we're in a practice room, but we are on the site of Carnegie Hall. It's the destination for so many musicians, practice, practice, practice. But the places you've been performing recently are quite a leap from Carnegie Hall. And they have nothing in common with Carnegie Hall. And so I thought we'd jump right in and let's talk about the discovering Bach. First of all, what did you do? What was the inspiration? And what was the aim or hope? Lay it out for our listeners, what this is about.
So in the fall or winter of 2015, for 33 days, I performed the entire cycle for solo violin of Bach in public spots all around New York City. I chose 33 days because one of the goals was to experience the cycle sort of from like an architectural point of view. I wanted to get through all 6 sonatas and partitas looking at each movement one by one as I made my way through. So every day was dedicated in my own personal way to one movement in the cycle. I would always perform at least the complete sonata, sometimes more, at every location, because I didn't want to just play 5 minutes and leave the room. That's kind of strange. But that was my way of sort of focusing on each movement individually and also within the entire whole picture. And I sort of scheduled some days off in it. So I thought 33 days had some sort of nice allusions to other significant numbers for Bach. And that was my plan. The inspiration came to me when I was actually in the midst of recording the CD. So I had been dreaming about this project probably at least a year. And it was the E major partita in particular that sort of just was the impetus for this whole thing. Because when you are wrestling with these works by yourself, as a violinist, this repertoire is unique because it, at the same time as being some of the most profound, important, challenging works we have, they're also entirely solo. So unlike pianists who have tons and tons of their whole lifetime is spent one-on-one with the composer, these are really unique for that purpose. They're also terrifying works. So there's all of this sort of emotion and questions in my mind about how I'm going to tackle this music. And, you know, it's my first CD. And am I too young to be playing Bach? All of these questions that we wrestle with. And, you know, the Chaconne and the C major fugue, these huge, like, philosophical works. And I was really feeling the heaviness of it. I was kind of holed up in my studio apartment in the wintertime, not leaving the house. And then I was working on the E major partita. And I just had this one moment where the joy of the dance was crystal clear to me. And I think I hadn't felt it yet in the cycle. And I just realized, like, you know, even from the very first motive, it's almost like all of a sudden this leading tone, the da-da-dum-bum-bum-bum-bum, it's almost like he's rejoicing in the fact that we're in E major. And I was thinking about that juxtaposed to the A minor fugue, which has the same da-da-dum-bum-bum, the same almost like this appoggiatura, which in the A minor fugue is such a different color, and all the chromaticism in that fugue, it's like as soon as he tries to announce a cadence, the counterpoint takes it somewhere else, and it's this falling figure, and there's really no confidence in the harmonic language. It's colored in a very different way. And to reach this E major partita where every single movement is this sort of ecstatic joy, we don't even really have a true slow movement. There's no sarabande or anything. It just sort of made me understand from a different angle how, yeah, Bach is a genius and he's on a pedestal and I will always be searching with the music and with my playing to get better and to change interpretations and everything else. But at the end of the day, he was a person, and they're joyful and they're raw and they're spontaneous. And everything just sort of made sense to me about this being like also such a sweet way to end the cycle that we're here on Earth. And like, in a way, it's a necessary thing to end with. So that's all to say that that moment sort of, I was in the midst of sort of trying to build this sculpture, and, you know, making a CD is this kind of impossible ideal, which can let you get to such amazing places because you have the time to sort of isolate yourself and create this thing that is sort of like a mix between where you are in that point in time. And at the same time, it's a fixed moment, which is kind of an interesting paradox. So I sort of had this urge to just like literally break the molding and like, maybe it was because it was wintertime, just like get outside and bring someone else into that sphere with me. Because like playing Bach is so raw and intimate. It's one of the most incredible feelings I've ever had is when I'm working on this music. No matter where I am, if I'm in a room by myself or on a stage, it always feels exactly the same way in terms of its power and its intimacy. And I wanted to just give that to other people. So I thought, well, how can I just like bring this music up close to as many people as possible? And what would happen? And was very loosely inspired, the structure of it, by the Banksy project, which was earlier that October, where what was striking to me about that, so he's a graffiti artist who every day in New York would sort of pop up with a different piece of art, and it was just funny kind of, you know, happened once near my apartment, and we were able to go witness all these funny people like posing with the picture, and then you hear the sirens coming. It's like maybe it's a whole ironic thing that I don't know enough about. But what was interesting to me was the fact that graffiti, because it lives on the street as an art form, it can exist in this intersection between public and private. So nothing gets lost, nothing gets diluted between the product and a whole incredible, huge audience. So I said, well, a violin can't exactly stand on the street and give people the Bach chaconne because no one will hear it and everything else. But I said, but what could I do? How could I devise a way to bring this music into other spheres and sort of like give them a punch in the gut with it? So that was my kind of question. And those were the things at play for me. On the one hand, there was my recognition that the CD is just the beginning. Making the CD and going through that process brought me to such depths with the music and made me face a lot of, you know, technical challenges and brought my playing to a new place. But I always knew that that was just the beginning for me with Bach and that it's an ongoing process forever. So it was sort of acknowledging that and sort of saying, what's the next step? What's the next step? And how can I get even closer to the music? And I wanted to do it with an audience. So those were some of the things at play inspiring me to do this project.
I like the juxtaposition, as I've read leading up to this, about there's some solitude of playing these as a violinist, and these are so important to a violinist's repertoire.
Yeah.
And then your urge to make them public outside of a concert setting. People pay a ticket, you sit there, it's a recital, that's part of the recital. But that is a quantum leap. I mean, there have been instrumentalists of top rank who have gone out in, one thinks of Joshua Bell's thing in the subway in Washington.
Right.
But this is all tied up with Bach. It's tied up with the fact that these are solo pieces. It's tied up with this urge to put them in front of people in close proximity.
Yeah.
So, okay, you've figured out you're going to do this. You've got the gumption up that I'm going to go do this. Now you have to go and do it. So you have to pick places. You have to pick venues. I know it started in a Hungarian bakery.
Yeah.
But did you already have, I'm going to do this for X number of days? You had that kind of in your head.
I felt
really... Or did it roll as it happened?
So the certain things that were like crystal clear from the beginning, which is also why it took me so long to actually do the project, was that I wanted to do it for a whole month. I think because I've had so much distance from the project now, it's also taken on its own life. And trying to remember one of the real urges for me that was compelling me to do this was actually because I wanted to prepare. Up until this point, I'd never done a marathon performance of all six.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, there's all these other interesting ideas that came out of it and still kind of pose questions for me. But it started really from like a violinist point of saying, okay, well, how does one prepare for a marathon all at once? Because I didn't record them all in one day, obviously.
Right.
And I said, well, okay, I've practiced them in so many different ways. What if I dedicated a different kind of pacing to each movement? How would that feel to me? I totally believe that Bach structured them in this way and ordered them in this way. How would it feel to sort of walk through this cathedral one step at a time? So the month long was very important to me because it's pretty impractical, first of all, for logistic reasons. Like, I had to find a month where I was actually in town for 33 days, and that was hard. And, you know, I had to say no to other concerts and stuff. And everyone was telling me, why don't you just do a week? What's the big deal? Why don't you do 6 days? Why don't you do this? Why don't you do that? And there was something so, like, in the middle of it, I was kind of hating myself at times because it was so difficult to perform every single day like that. But there was something so rewarding about, like, sort of trudging through in that way, like being in G minor for 4 days and being in B minor for, I don't remember, I guess it probably was seven, you know, So things like that, by the time I got to the Chaconne, it really felt like climbing through it. And
you had criteria for where. I mean, it was obviously a noise factor.
Yeah.
You have to be heard, otherwise you're doing disservice to the music and people trying to hear you.
Yeah.
There was a disruption factor. You didn't want to go someplace where they're saying, could you please move because we're trying to do something else here. So as you rolled this out, the venues kind of happened? You had them set up?
Absolutely. The most important thing for me was that this was not like a gimmick or a performance art thing.
Right.
I care about the music and I care about the audience, and I wanted people to have a chance to experience it. So that was my number one criteria for where I played. The Hungarian Pastry Shop, let's start there. It was one of these places that I just love, and I always wanted to play there. When I was in undergrad at Columbia, I would do all my studying there, probably the only way I passed my classes, you know. So I always had this sort of dream to play there. So how did I set that up? I called the owners for a bunch of months until I, you know, befriended them, and now they're, you know, dear friends, and we scheduled it. I remember calling them in the summer times, you know, so that was a very long game to get that scheduled in. The Staten Island Ferry was a spontaneous decision. I knew I wanted to play there because I thought it would be fun. I'd never been there before, and it turned out to be this amazingly fun day. But I didn't ask permission beforehand because I probably would have gotten a no.
Right.
So that was some. So the way I structured it, when I started it, all 33 locations were not filled in, which was scary, but also good because I knew that there was a type of location like the Veterans Hospital, which was a very specific researched collaboration that was planned well in advance. The Hungarian Pastry Shop, I have a friend who works at BuzzFeed, so I was able to go into their amazingly cool offices and play a concert for all of these, like, you know, tech guys swirled out of their computer cubicles and just sat and listened to me. So those things that were planned well in advance. There were the places I knew I wanted to go that were spontaneous, like the Staten Island Ferry, or this bus that I ended up on at the end of Brooklyn after I played at a retirement home. We were the only people on the bus. It was like the end of the line, and he was getting ready to move the bus. So before we moved, I gave him a little concert. So that was a total spur of the moment. And, you know, I was doing a gig at BAM for a week, and I didn't have anything scheduled that day, and I had always wanted to play at a Firehouse because whenever I called them, they were like, you know, we don't really have time to, like, schedule a concert. You know, so I had sort of taken that off my dream list. Yeah, but there happened to be a fire station very close to BAM, so one day in between shows, I just decided to walk over, and I literally, like, knocked on the door, and I asked, do you mind if I play a concert for you guys? And they let me in, and I played for all these firemen, just totally. So things like that, I left room for, I wanted to leave a certain
days
open.
Yeah, that was my thing, as you did this, as it started to organically grow.
Yeah.
There were probably places when you started saying, oh, I can do here, and then as you went, you said that probably won't work, and things you didn't expect to. So
absolutely.
There was a lot of spontaneity
absolutely.
To this,
absolutely.
Which, though tiring to go 33 days, was probably exciting.
Yeah.
Because you didn't really know maybe where you were going to play next week.
Absolutely. I mean, I never said no. So, like, the reason why it was 33 days and not 27 is because I had devised a day of rest after each to sort of, like, get back into my cocoon as a performer, too, because this is, like, a terrifying thing to do. And also as a person, you're like, you know, you have to have a lot of guts to just get up and play for strangers. But I ended up never being able to take a day off because things would come up, you know. So every location was very specific to me, too, like Trader Joe's, you know. That's the place I just think they're so nice there. That took a lot of planning. I played at this Holy Apostles Soup Kitchen, which was an amazing experience. And I remember that took a few months to plan as well, and I had to work really hard to get that gig. Like, I had to send recordings on my website, and then she was like, you can only come if you play for 3 hours. So, because they have so many people who want to play there that you need to fill all the time. So I took that. That was the first time I ever, in public, played the whole cycle straight through. But later that day, I was also playing at a police precinct. So that was one of my days off, I think, in the 33-day structure. But
so that answers the question.
Because, yeah.
I mean, I'm thinking of questions that they'd like to. I mean, this happened at different times of the day.
Yeah.
So you would get up when you were doing this and know that you were going to play somewhere planned, not know maybe if something else would come up, and you just went out and I mean, you did other things during your day, but that was the goal of each day, was to have this performance, right?
Right. So
somewhere.
Yeah. So, I mean, the whole point of this was that every day I would be practicing this one movement, go out and perform it, and come home and write my blog. But with the traveling, right. You know, the structure of the day was, those were my three things that I had to hit, which was exhausting and stimulating, and it was wonderful.
Actual performances.
Yes.
You close your eyes when you perform, usually.
Yes.
As you did these, could you sense, because if you're in a public place, you might have people who stop in their tracks the minute you make a noise, but there's also transient people that will move in and out and come in the middle if it's someplace public. Could you sense as you did these, the audience from the first note you hit till the end? I mean, was there this kind of weird type of telepathic thing going on?
Absolutely. While it was happening, I sort of realized as the weeks went on that I started building this extra muscle. You know, as performers, we can tell so many things viscerally because we've practiced it. But this new thing of, like, being able to feel the room and knowing if I need to talk first or not, and, like, when to just start playing and getting more confident with that surprise factor, and just what was really humbling for me was to have this, like, reassurance that the music will sort of urge people to listen rather than asking them. So I had this one specific example was at the Book Court, which I just looked online. I think they had to close in Brooklyn, this beautiful bookstore. But I played there, and that was sort of like a half pop-up, half advertised concerts, because some people didn't know I was playing it, but I think it was a weekend, so it was a highly trafficked place with just people there at the bookshop. So I had some people who had come just to hear the concert, and there were sort of some chairs set up, but when I got there, I think it was in the D minor partita, so it was a couple weeks in. If it had been the first day, I probably would have maybe, like, tried to make an announcement or have someone introduce me, but at that point, I just believed that it would work on its own. So my violin was in the corner of the room, and I think I started playing the Allemande as I walked to the center of the room, and I just didn't even care. I knew people who wanted to listen would come, and in between movements, if I opened my eyes, I could see everybody was there. And there was sort of this sixth sense that I was able to gain of feeling out my audience and being able to trust them as well. That was fun. And also, it was really cool to hear the different acoustics in every place. One moment that was a total shock because it was just such a huge space that I couldn't have my tentacles couldn't have been that well tuned. But when I played at the Rockefeller, there's this atrium. I think it's like a science lab. So it was like a 6-story atrium, and there's this huge circular staircase and labs on each floor with unbelievable acoustics. Yeah. So I scheduled a lunchtime. My brother studied there, so he connected me with a friend and so on and so forth. So I stood on one of the balconies and played the entire D minor partita. And the acoustics in there are so gorgeous. And I didn't say anything. And at the end, I mean, I think every so often I could sort of tell people were coming out. When, at the end of the Chaconne, I mean, people had come out of all of the labs and were just standing there applauding. And what was the coolest thing is, like, after I finished and after the applause ended, like, nobody moved.
Right.
I've been playing for almost half an hour. So I said, well, okay, I think they're expecting me to say something. So I actually spoke to this huge, you know, space and explained who I was and what I had played. And that was so moving to me.
Yeah, you had to make a lot of, I mean, like I said, talking to the audience. You have to really weigh, is this a place where what I'm going to say will be understood? Do they care? Yeah. Or are they just soaking up? And the close proximity, I mean, if you're doing a recital, you're on a stage and the closest people to you are the people in the front row.
Right.
But here, there you have people feet from you.
Yeah.
What about feedback? Either directly after or now months and months and months after? I mean, has there been any? Has anything surprised you? Or
yeah, I mean, it's just amazing because I keep having opportunities to talk about it. You know, there was this writer who happened by chance to hear me on the last day at the... I wanted to do this whole thing that would end in a formal concert somewhere where I could play all six, and I just couldn't schedule it. So I ended up allowing the spirit of the project to turn the last day into a Pied Piper marathon. Yeah. So instead of playing them in one spot, I bounced around, and people sort of followed me through. And one woman saw me play at the St. John Cathedral, and then I announced that I was going across the street to Hungary, and I started and ended there to play the C major sonata. So she came and afterwards introduced herself to me, and a few months later found me on Twitter or something and said, I'd like to interview you. So we did this whole long reads article, and you know, it just kept kind of spiraling. I was pretty adamant about not really publicizing it. I mean, I did have a blog. A friend of mine who helped me build the website was pretty much pulling me by my hair to put the website out because this was such an important thing to me, but I'm actually quite a private person, especially when it comes to your music and your feelings about it, and anyone would be scared to put themselves out there like this. So I didn't, like, try and get publicity while I was doing it, mainly because I felt like I wanted to do the project for all of the right reasons. You know, it just was such a pure thing for me, so I didn't want it to seem like a thing I was doing just for that. But what was surprising is how people would sort of, like, find me on my website and write to me, or basically just like the incredible openness from all the performances. I mean, the reason why I always talk about the Hungarian Pastry Shop is because, like, I've been there, I've studied there, I love that spot. There's a really intense energy. It's almost an intimidating place to just go in and start playing.
Right.
The whole time leading up to this project, I was my biggest devil's advocate, saying there's no way this is going to work. Acoustic instruments cannot just, like, you know, I'm not that kind of... I didn't really believe it would work. And that first day proved me completely wrong because I started to tune and everybody...
Shut up.
They stopped. So I got up and I played, and I played the Adagio and Fugue straight through, and everyone was like, that kind of energy, you don't feel it in a concert hall in the same way. It's not to say one is better than the other, but that was so shocking. And I think it was really amazing to have that daily perspective when you're in your practice room, when you're working, no matter how close you feel to the music sometimes, you're always hard on yourself, and you have to be. You have to have those standards to push yourself to get better. But if you go out and you play for someone, they're going to have so much gratitude for the music, and that daily perspective was what kind of kept me going, you know. Even if it was just one person who stopped and listened to me. And when I was playing on the 242nd Street, then Cortlandt Park, the one stop has this archway. So that was like the one subway exception because it was really quiet. And I was home for Thanksgiving. My family lives in Westchester, so my mom drove me there and she was sort of filming it. I didn't have anybody else with me that day. And this one woman stopped with her huge bags of groceries and listened to the entire performance and was like hugging me and crying afterwards. So that for me was like all I needed. You know, that was so special. And the surprising thing that happened was about a month after this, I was in Switzerland doing a concert for Juilliard, and it was the first time I had played Bach in a concert since my project. And I was on a stage in a ball gown, far away from the audience, and it was so strange, because all of a sudden, the opposite thing happened. I was like, wait, where are they? Why can't I hear them breathing? So it was this really funny switch of perspective. So now, like, when I'm playing concerts, I also trust my own stage presence a little better, because it sort of took away the veil that we feel on stage, where it's sort of like you think you're the only person there. I mean, you play for your audience, but you're never aware of them, because if you did, you'd get distracted, right? You're playing always for, like, the composer, I think. But this project forced me to come into contact with that kind of elephant in the room right there. There are living, breathing people hearing this and experience this with you, that it's actually like a communal experience playing music.
That's what I think you would miss. You'd miss that really sort of dynamic nature of doing that, which you can't duplicate in a concert setting. You can, but we're going to talk about a concert you have coming up at La Place en Rouge, which is a non-traditional venue, and the people are eating and they're closer to you. But still, it's not the same thing.
I was feeling confident that I can play at LPR because of what I've experienced. Well,
I know, but you still have that thing where you've played and the audience wasn't there. You created an audience, and that's a very different dynamic.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I had a question to wrap this up of how did it change you as a musician playing Bach, as a person. You've answered a lot of those in what you've been talking about here. I think as a person, I'm interested because, to sort of move away from the discovering Bach, I mean, part of your studies, you spent like 10 years studying with Itzhak Perlman. I mean, that's such a big personality he has, and you can see that in him. And you said you weren't the most outgoing, as you said before, but I mean, this had to change you in some way.
Well, whether or not I'm outgoing, I think it's that, like, music is so precious. It's like it feels like your soul, you know, when you're playing. So I think there's that where it's, Mr. Perlman, the one thing that he has that I think is so palpable, whether you're in a room with him or he's playing or you hear him speaking about anything, his heart is so huge and he knows how to connect to people. And I think that's why his playing is so moving. You can hear one note on the radio and you know it's him, because like in every single millisecond of his sound, his whole heart and his voice is speaking and it cuts right to you. And I think his charm when he's on stage, and he always makes jokes, and he just has this incredible natural gift to make people feel at ease. So I think that was like on a subconscious level, always a kind of grounding thing for me, is why am I playing music? It's to speak to one another, you know? It's to speak with your heart, from your heart. So, like, this was a very strange tangent from the same, maybe, point.
Yeah, because as you did this project, you had to grow that skill of making people feel comfortable that you were doing this in a place that they didn't expect it.
Yeah.
Made them feel awkward, not sure what to do. Do we listen to her? Do we, you know?
Right.
So you've got to make the audience know that this is okay. Like you said, it wasn't a gimmick. You're trying to sell them anything.
No,
you know,
I rarely
whip
like
out
even
the
told
CDs
them
afterwards to say you could buy it here.
Well, the
I
whole
mean, it
funny thing is
thing,
I didn't even have the CD, so it was perfect. You know, most of the time I forgot to say who I was or what I was doing, you know, because I just wanted to give them Bach. Like,
right, yeah.
You know, really is all I cared about. But I do think having met Mr. Perlman at the age of 12 and him being my main teacher, my main influence, you know, he just believes that music should be from the heart. And I think that kind of philosophy was definitely present in probably everything I do, but even in this project, I mean, I never made the direct connection to it.
So Would you do it again? Would you take it somewhere else? Have there been other violinists who have talked to you about you're sort of inspiring them to do something similar? I mean, what has been the...
So I've been, like, dreaming of taking this on the road. It's just it's a little hard to facilitate. But I am doing this again right before LPR in a very small version.
Okay.
So I thought it would be nice to kind of tie it all together
yeah.
in New York before I find the means and time to do it someplace else. So I'm actually still in the process of deciding on where I'm going to play at the moment.
What about other violinists? Have you had feedback from them? I mean, they're probably pretty curious on how you pulled this off. Did you inspire them to...
I don't know. I mean, friends have been really supportive.
Yeah.
And everyone seems to be curious about the project. And I had some filmmaker friends who were really sweet and lent their time. So I, when trailers would come, I have like a video that came out months after the project. So it's nice to revisit it. I don't know if anyone has been directly inspired by it, but people have been really supportive. One thing that I think I might do, if I can figure it out, I do like the idea of doing a month because there was something almost meditative about it, like knowing that even if I had other concerts and gigs, like it's like now I'm running every day. It's a similar thing where
yeah.
you just make the time for it if you've decided. So now my next, I'm sort of in the beginning stages of it, and I might try it next week, is in addition to playing Bach, playing my own improvisations too. And I thought that would be cool to like go to a specific place. And I've been dreaming about going to Iceland recently. So like somehow going to Iceland, for example, and writing a new improvisation every day and sort
yeah.
of challenging myself to do something like that. So sort of, you know, until I learn the Izai sonatas or something.
Right.
Something that I can do on my own, and it's pushing me forward with my craft, which was a big part of it, and connecting to your surroundings and stuff. And the blog was really fun for me, and I love to write. So the answer is yes. I'll be doing it for the week before the LPR concert, but hopefully I'll find another month to do this again.
Here are a few moments from my guest Michelle Ross's improvisation inspired by Bach, specifically the Sarabande from the Partita No. 1 in B minor, BWV 1002. This called Fantasia and Sarabande.
To really fill me in on this. So you're taking your performing side and your creating side, and you're putting them in a space to make this happen, which is another art discipline or visual art discipline, right? With this gallery. What are you doing here? Because this is also pretty interesting.
So 11th Street Arts is my little oasis in New York. It is a gallery space that is located within the Grand Central Atelier.
Okay.
So this is an art school shared studio space. It's a classical realist art school founded by Jacob Collins, and it's in Long Island City. My mother is a painter, so she used to take classes there. And years ago, I gave a concert there, and when I was starting to do my Bach project, I contacted them and said, could I come back and play here? So I played 3 recitals at the gallery, and I just fell in love with this place. So the gallery has beautiful acoustics, it's intimate, it's surrounded by these incredible paintings, and the community of artists that I am now friends with and interact with are so inspiring. They're so dedicated to their craft. And we think as classical musicians, we're sort of swimming upstream,
mm-hmm.
you know, within the context of other art and music that's popular. But to see the dedication that these artists have to learning a craft that is a long tradition, and it's classical drawing and painting, so they're working, you know, I don't know, 12, 14 hours a day, and, you know, just learning how to draw like these old masters. So when I'm there talking about Bach and line and counterpoint and architecture and all of this stuff, they're just curious and hungry, and they understand all the same concepts. So I found a huge kindred sort of connection with these worlds. So after I played the recitals there, they sort of offered me this artist residency there. They got a piano and the gallery. So this past year, I've been going whenever I'm in town, practicing and composing in the gallery there. And we also launched the first season of chamber music series there, chamber music at 11th Street Arts. So I really wanted to introduce other musicians and repertoire into this amazing space. So,
but you do this while the gallery is open, so it's like a living, breathing type of thing going on. It's absolutely not like closed doors after hours.
So what's really cool is that when I'm there composing, like, I get to know all the paintings, like, pretty much more than anybody else, because I'm there. It's been really wonderful for me. And sometimes I don't bring my violin at all because I'm trying to focus more time on composing. It really inspires me to just, like, stick it out, because they're there painting next door. So I tried to separate it a little bit, which has really helped me sort of organize my work as well. But yeah, the concerts there this year have been so magical, actually. Like, there's always like a 45-minute Q&A after the concert, and it's so wonderful to have my peers and friends bring their artistry, come into the space and get that energy feedback. I think it's just really joyful for me to be able to share that with so many people, because playing at that gallery, something about it really pushed me. Like, I think performing for this unique audience that understands what you do but isn't judging you in the same way. Not that classical musicians judge each other, but perhaps you judge yourself more when you're playing at Carnegie Hall or so on and so forth. So when you're in a space where I just found myself taking risks in a new way, and that energy was so powerful for me, and the sort of the discourse that would happen afterwards, I just really wanted to open that up and see what happens. So it's been really fun programming
stuff.
Well,
to go back to audiences, whether it's at the gallery, whether it was at any of your 33 days of discovering Bach, there's an expectation. And the audiences you played Bach for in and around New York City had very different expectations than those buying a ticket and coming to Carnegie Hall.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating because it's a huge, wide spectrum.
It's fun at the gallery because, like, someone's singing Die Liebe and there's 100 paintings on the wall, and many of the painters are in the audience, and when they were singing, I was in the back, and someone was sketching, you know? It's like, that is so, so exciting.
Synergy between different arts.
Yeah.
The concert you're going to do at La Place en Rouge also allows you to do what a lot of artists in your sort of age spectrum are doing now, both in concert and on recordings, is taking the synergy of music across centuries and styles, which means you, in this case, you can take movements of the Bach sonatas and partitas, and you can intersperse them with music that on paper may say, well, what's this about?
Yeah.
But you're trying to make it work. And a lot of string quartets are doing this, and pianists are doing this, and you can see it what they're doing. So a little bit about this, what you're going to present at LPR.
Okay, so what I wanted to do at LPR was, in a smaller time frame, sort of tell the story of the art. So I'm playing selections from all six of the sonatas and partitas, and pairing them with different pieces. So I'll be starting with Ravel Kaddish, which is a Hebrew melody. It's a sort of like a prayer for the dead. And I always loved the piece and loved performing it. I sort of had this instinct to pair it with the G minor sonata because it has this sort of subtle allusion to the Sei Solo narrative, perhaps, you know, the whole speculation about Maria Barbara and that whole journey. And I think harmonically it kind of sets up G minor in an interesting way, sort of being the very beginning of this announcement of this journey. So I'll be playing that. The second segment will center on the B minor partita. And as I've been exploring improvisation a lot this year, I've been toying around with this sort of little improvisation that is directly inspired from the B minor sarabande and also has some fiddling influences, sort of plays off my idea of these worlds not being so separate from each other. I don't actually have a fiddling background, but I've been surrounded by a lot of sort of jazz and bluegrass players this year, playing with friends, and it's been somehow seeping its way into my voice in interesting ways. The third segment will be a piece of mine that I wrote when I was 16 called To the Moon for Violin and Piano Again. It's about lost love and sort of circles around the A Lydian harmonically, so I thought that would be a nice pairing with the A minor allegro. Then I'll probably take a short pause to set up the second half of the program, which will be the chaconne. The chaconne, for me, I wanted it to sit in the center of the program, right, the way it does in the cycle, in the 0.618, sort of, right after the half mark. And this is, in my mind, this whole monument of the six sonatas and partitas, I think Bach put them together, so the chaconne would have a place to live. And in the manuscript, whether or not this is accurate, it's sort of a beautiful idea. The C major adagio sort of fits in on the manuscript right underneath the chaconne on the adjacent page to the C major fugue. You know, we've gone on this G minor, B minor, A minor, D minor, going deeper and deeper and deeper, and sort of here we are at the chaconne, and I've sort of come to realize that it's the chaconne's power is really the fact that it is in three segments, and there are no rests until the very, very last reiteration of the theme. We go into D major and we come back, and it's that return that is so powerful, and the fact that this relentless rhythm never stops. Where do we go from there? And the fact that Bach takes us finally to our first major key of C major, no sharps or flats, and the two unison Ds that the chaconne finishes on, if you think of them as two voices, if you think of them, one goes down to the C and becomes a heartbeat, and the second voice comes in a measure later in the adagio as its counterpoint, rubbing against that. And then from there, we have this another rhythmic pattern that doesn't stop and sort of is like the heartbeat coming back to real life. Mm-hmm. In a way, purifying us after everything we've been through and leading us outward and leading us to the C major fugue, which in length and so many other attributes is almost like the chaconne's complete complementary opposite. And I always think of them as sort of as like, you know, the fulcrum of this universe that is the cycle. And from there, we, after the C major sonata, we finally land in E major in this ecstatic joy and this arrival and the transformation of this sort of leading tone figure, and now it's something that's rejoicing. And so to end my program at LPR, I'll be playing the Messiaen Louange, the last movement from the quartet for the end of time, which is another sort of relentless heartbeat up into the heavens, and finishing with the E major preludio. So all of the extra pieces that I'm interspersing sort of sit on the same kind of narrative that the way that I'm seeing these sonatas and partitas sitting in.
It's fascinating. I mean, that you can do what you did with the Bach in the Discovering Bach project and then move to here. What about going forward? What's on tap for the next year or 2 years, 3 years? I mean, where do you want to go?
It's so wonderful, terrible question. Right now, actually, composing is really important to me. And that's a whole nother, it's like a long game. That's what I'm learning. Right now, I'm in an interesting spot because I told myself last summer composing is my focus right now. And what happened in between was that actually my improvising skills were getting better and better, because I use improvising as sort of like for me, it's an intersection between performing and composing. It's also this sort of mysterious door into your imagination and all of these themes that have been swirling around since I was 13 or 14 and are still there and finding their ways. Sometimes I'll be playing chords on the piano, which I find out later, just after I've written them down, that are the same as these weird arpeggiated things that don't even sound like chords on the violin. When I put them side to side, I say, well, am I intellectually exploring the same harmony? Is it a coincidence? Is this just the sound world that I love? So for me, improvising is a double love, because on the one hand, I can perform an unfinished work, an unfinished look into sort of like a sketch, the way a lot of painters and sculptors, their sketches are beautiful. They're not finished products, but they exist on their own as steps towards something bigger. So as I'm improvising on violin and piano, I'm finding my voice as an improviser. In the beginning, improvising was a way into composing for me, because it sort of happened by accident, and all of a sudden I realized that it was like looking into my imagination. And now I have to be kind of strict with myself about calling them two different things. Mm. I hadn't taken composition lessons in about 10 years, and it was something I was kind of afraid to do. Now I've been taking lessons again, and it's making me realize that I have to be strict with myself, because composing is a very different art form. It's very different to have a live performance that is an improvisation that is, you know, beautiful and interesting in the fact that it's exploring something in real time. But a composition is sort of almost the opposite of that, is what I'm realizing. How can you bring the simplest idea and expand that into something interesting? You know, how can you make something interesting out of almost the bare minimum, which is kind of the opposite. It's not the opposite as improvising, because I'm learning now that I have to start to internalize things like pattern and structure if I want to be an improviser as well, because you have to tell a story also. So the same elements come into play, but it's a lot looser with improvising, and I love the magic of it being mysterious. I mean, sometimes it's frustrating because it's like, well, if I'm not really feeling it, how am I going to get there? But I always seem to get there, and that process is revealing. But I'm working on a string quartet right now, and I have a clarinet piece a friend of mine asked me to write, and all of these things I really want to do. But knowing how much craft goes into it, it's sort of like a daunting thought, because I have to sort of be strict with my time and stuff. So other than that, I'll be playing in Europe this summer and in the fall, and I have my festival in Utah that I think will be happening again this year a little later than it has been in the past. And yeah, we'll see how things develop. It's hard for me to know what the next big step is. Yeah, I don't know.
Well, if any consolation, Bach had the same problems going between improvisation and composition.
Really?
As well. Well, I mean, he was a master improviser, yeah. So he had to think at some point, of course, on a much exalted level than you or I could reach, but, you know, what I just played, is that what I want to codify into, yeah, or do I just leave it as an improvisation?
Exactly. I like to think that, like, the chaconne is just one chaconne that he happened to write down.
Exactly.
You know, which brings me back to this whole, like, thing about, yeah, I mean, but you can kind of get lost in improvising, mm-hmm, which is great and not great at the same time. So...
Well, I wish you a lot of success going forward.
Well, thank you.
Keep an eye on things. I close all my cadenza interviews by asking my guests the same two questions. The first is a hypothetical, which says, if you could chat with somebody from the past, somebody you have a chance to, never could. Now, it might be obvious who you might pick here, but what name pops into your head when I ask that? Just a person you'd love to chat with who you never had a chance from the past. I mean, one might think that it would be... Well, if you think too hard, you get flooded. So just when I first asked that, what would be the first person that you'd love to talk with?
The first person that popped into my mind was Pablo Neruda.
Okay.
Which is not where you wanted me to go.
No, I've been all over the map with this over the years.
Part of me doesn't... The thing about meeting composers would, like... I kind of don't want the bubble to burst,
okay,
in a way. Because I feel like we know these composers better than... Knowing them in real life could ever give us.
It'd be interesting to get Bach's take on what you did.
I would just, like, probably be way too scared. I don't know.
Whether you even saw these pieces as being not only public pieces, but pieces to be performed in front of an audience.
What
probably
about
not.
Pieces to be recorded?
Yeah.
I always think about that's kind of wild. Like, all this music was written in a time before people ever dreamed that people would be recording and dissecting. And
yeah, sure.
So, I mean,
music
I don't
was temporal for them. It just existed.
Yeah.
And then they went on something new.
And I think there's also this idea that's scary about, like, humanizing someone that we exalt so much that would kind of, it might just freak us out a little bit. I don't know.
The final question is a non-musical question. Everybody I interview on Cadenza fills their life with music. You've been very busy. When you have to do something that is non-musical, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, but can pull yourself back. So when you woke up, when you were doing the 33 days, you said, I'm done with that. I mean, what did you do when you have to do something that's non-musical?
I like yoga. Okay. And I started running, which is really been something that's given me a lot of relaxation, actually. And I love to read. That's the first thing I did that January afterwards. It's like I got a whole bunch of books and just sort of indulged myself in reading and poetry and stuff like that. So,
has it made you more aware of music that's around you in public, like whether it's piped in music? It's strange how we tune it out.
Yeah. What it made me much more aware of was actually New York City. Because I'd been living here, I went to college here, and now if I ever walk by some cute little spot, I still to myself think, oh, I should play here. Or it just opened my eyes up. I remember I went to Coney Island one day in the winter. So I'd wanted to play at Coney Island. This was the only day I had time to go. And I went, and it was windy and everything else. But, like, things like that, which commuting 20 minutes sometimes you're frustrated about. But there was something so joyful about, like, taking the subway all the way to the edge just sort of for the random idea of going to visit Coney Island. So things like that, it made me much more aware of and find more joy in people and sort of make more eye contact with people and smile more at people and realizing, like, the line between someone being a stranger that you never interact with and them, like, opening up their heart to you and vice versa was so thin, I realized, through this. I try and remember that as much as possible. Whenever I'm traveling, I'm always thinking, oh, I should be playing Bach right now.
Well, if you're in New York City and you're someplace and Bach starts to emerge live, look around for Michelle Ross. Thanks for taking some
time. Thank you for having me.
Violinist Michelle Ross. You can find out more about her at her website, mrr662.wixsite.com, or simply Google her name, Michelle Ross. Her performance at Le Poisson Rouge, 158 Bleecker Street in Greenwich Village in New York City, is this Sunday at 4:30 p.m. Check out more information about that at Le Poisson Rouge's website, lpr.com. All the music of Bach you heard in this program comes from my guest's new release of the 6 Sonatas and Partitas for Solo Violin, released on the Albany Records label. Check it out at albanyrecords.com. I'll leave you with the final movement, the Gigue, from the final entry, the Partita No. 3 in E major, BWV 1006, performed by my guest today, Michelle Ross. And as always, I'm glad you were in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to WWFM and click on webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org. The other.